I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's May 10th, and we have a lot to talk about. And as I've done a few times before, I want to pump the brakes on this episode so I can take just a minute to say thank you to each of you in the Real Talk MS listener community. Last week, one of the major media hosting companies published some updated statistics about podcasts, and I hope you'll indulge me while I share just a few of those statistics with you. As of last month, believe it or not, there are 4,058,150 podcasts registered around the world. And of those, 2,440,383 podcasts are available on Apple Podcasts. Of these 2.4 million podcasts, only 512,480 are considered active. That is, these roughly 500,000 podcasts have published at least one episode in the past 90 days. And if you look at the number of downloads an episode receives within the first 7 days of its release, that's the standard that the podcast industry uses to measure downloads per episode. If your podcast episode receives 335 downloads within 7 days, you're in the top 10% of all podcasts. If your podcast episode receives 795 downloads within those first 7 days, you're in the top 5% of all podcasts. And if your podcast episode receives 3,994 downloads within those first 7 days, well, you're in the top 1% of all podcasts. To give you a little perspective, this podcast doesn't receive 3,994 downloads within the first 7 days of a new episode becoming available. It receives almost three times that number. And that's why I wanted to take this time to say thank you, because you not only listen to every episode of Real Talk MS, but you keep coming back. And more of you are getting comfortable talking back as well. I appreciate every email and DM that I receive from you, and I try to respond to all of them. So thank you for putting Real Talk MS easily into the top 1% of all podcasts in the world. But more importantly to me, for making Real Talk MS one of the top podcasts for the MS community. Thank you again for choosing to continue the conversation with me every week. I've never met anyone living with MS who couldn't tell me the exact date they received their MS diagnosis. Now, being diagnosed doesn't really change anything. It's likely that on the day you receive your diagnosis, you're pretty much the same as you were the day before you received your diagnosis, and you'll probably be the same the day after you receive that diagnosis. But things do seem to change in that moment, on that day. Whether we're being diagnosed or we're with a loved one as they're being diagnosed, I think we all do a little recalibrating of what the future may have in store for us. We invite a bunch of what-ifs into our lives. And because of the unpredictable nature of MS, it can feel like those what-ifs stay with us far too long. For some people, the journey to their MS diagnosis is relatively quick and straightforward. For others, it's anything but. I still talk to people who tell me they waited years to have their MS diagnosis confirmed. Joining me today to shine a bright light on that path to an MS diagnosis is Dr. Michael Robers. Dr. Robers is a neurologist in the Multiple Sclerosis Program and an assistant professor in the Department of Neurology at Barrow's Neurological Institute. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Michael Robers, there are a few other things that you should know about. For the longest time, MS was considered a disease that impacted white women. And while we know that's no longer true, I should also point out that there are doctors practicing medicine today who still believe this fallacy to be true. And this can end up adding years onto the amount of time a black person has to wait until they finally receive an MS diagnosis and can begin treatment with MS medications. So now we all understand that MS is an equal opportunity disease that can affect white people, black people, Hispanic people, Asian people. But do members of these different racial and ethnic populations all have the same chance of developing MS? In other words, is MS equally prevalent among these different racial and ethnic groups, or are there any differences? A Kaiser Permanente research team wanted to answer that question. So they analyzed the medical records of more than 2.6 million people who were treated by the Kaiser Permanente health system in Southern California. First, they wanted to determine how many of these people had an MS diagnosis in the year 2010, and they were able to identify 3,863 people with MS. When the researchers drilled down to the demographic information about these 3,863 people, they discovered that the prevalence of MS was about the same for white people and black people, with MS impacting 226 out of every 100,000 black people and 238 out of every 100,000 white people. They also discovered a fairly sharp decline in prevalence among Hispanic and Asian populations, with MS impacting 70 out of every 100,000 Hispanic people and 23 out of every 100,000 Asian people. Previous studies, some dating back decades, had indicated that the prevalence of MS among black people was much lower than among white people. Now, these outcomes underestimated black people with MS because they never considered the barriers and disparities black people faced in attempting to access healthcare. But this latest study provides new data that requires more inspection. Now, this was a study that limited itself to the Kaiser Permanente patient population in Southern California. It's going to be interesting to see the outcomes of future studies that look at a broader population sample. And it continues to be interesting to see how the social determinants of health can have such a profound impact on the well-being of any individual who's living with a chronic disease. If you'd like to review the details of the Kaiser Permanente study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. In 2018, Canada legalized the recreational use of cannabis, and a research team at the University of Alberta wanted to get an idea of how many people living with MS in Canada were now using cannabis, how they perceived the efficacy of cannabis in treating various MS symptoms, and what types of side effects they were experiencing. The researchers launched a survey and collected responses from 344 Canadians with MS. About 80% of the survey respondents indicated that they were living with relapsing remitting MS, and more than 75% of the respondents identified as female with an average age of 45. The survey results revealed that 52.3% of the respondents were currently using cannabis to manage their MS symptoms, with another 10% who indicated that they had tried cannabis in the past but weren't current users. Almost three-fourths of the current users indicated that they used cannabis daily. 84.1% of the respondents used it to help manage sleep problems. 80% used cannabis to help manage pain. 68.4% used it to help manage muscle spasms. 66.5% used cannabis to manage stress. And 59% used cannabis to help manage fatigue. The most common side effects reported included drowsiness, feeling quiet or subdued, having difficulty concentrating, experiencing balance problems, and incoherent thoughts. More than 80% of the users indicated that cannabis was effective in managing spasticity, pain, sleep problems, bad mood, and stress. And nearly all the users indicated that using cannabis seemed to stimulate their appetite, a side effect that's been long noted and often referred to colloquially as the munchies. And while this is all interesting news, this is also an extremely small sample. Considering that there are more than 93,000 people living with MS in Canada, the experiences of 1/3 of 1% of them can't really carry a whole lot of weight. But one of the things about this study that caught my attention was that most of the 180 survey respondents who were using cannabis indicated that they learned about cannabis from a friend or from doing their own online research rather than having a discussion with their healthcare provider. Now, you don't have to spend too much time online before you realize that there's a tremendous amount of information available to you. There's also a tremendous amount of misinformation equally available to you. And sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. And that's why when it comes to your health, it's so important to rely on trusted sources for your information. If you're a regular listener to this podcast, you already know that I try to make the information I share as transparent as possible. I only share information that's backed by evidence, and I always provide links to the source material, the actual published studies, in every episode's show notes. On those rare occasions when I want to share my opinion with you, I make sure that I let you know that it's my opinion and not anything more or less. But when it comes to cannabis, it seems that there's an undeniable interest among people living with MS, but they aren't necessarily sharing their curiosity with their doctors. The Cleveland Clinic conducted a nationwide survey across the United States to examine where people living with MS got their information about cannabis. The survey was conducted in March and April of the year 2020, and 6,934 people who were already participants in the North American Research Committee on MS Registry were invited to respond. Now, of those 6,934 people living with MS, 3,249 responded. And of those respondents, 31% reported ever having tried cannabis to manage their MS symptoms, with 20% currently using it. Of these 1,000 people who had tried or were still using cannabis to manage their MS symptoms, half indicated that they didn't seek any medical guidance, and only about 120 survey respondents reported relying on guidance from their physician. This is a situation that really needs improvement. Cannabis is no more a universal treatment than any other treatment you can think of. Virtually every medication has some sort of side effect. Now, we always hope that most of those side effects are minimal, but some aren't. For example, there's recent evidence that there are negative cognitive effects among people with MS who use cannabis over a long period of time. That sounds like a side effect you'd want to know about before starting any treatment. So, and I should point out, this part is my opinion. Two things need to happen. And they can happen at the same time. Both MS specialists and people living with MS need to have access to evidence-based information about cannabis and MS. Without it, how can there be any shared decision-making in considering cannabis as a potential symptom management treatment? The other thing that has to happen is that neurologists and people living with MS need to be comfortable talking about cannabis. Because cannabis no longer requires a prescription in many parts of this country, a neurologist really needs to ask whether their patient is using or considering using cannabis, just like they would ask about any other non-prescription supplement that could have a negative interaction with medications the patient's already being prescribed, or could carry some other risk of damaging side effects. Now, this isn't me coming out against cannabis as a potential treatment. Far from it. It's me coming out in favor of informed decision-making when it comes to any potential treatment, including cannabis. If you'd like to review the details of either the Canadian study or the Cleveland Clinic study, you'll find links to both in today's show notes. I want to give you a reminder that if you're a caregiver for someone living with MS, or if you're a healthcare provider who interacts with MS caregivers, or if you're a researcher who focuses their work on MS caregivers, or who might like to explore MS caregiver research, iConquer MS, the people-powered MS research network, wants to hear from you. Now, iConquer MS is a virtual research community for people affected by MS. It currently has over 8,000 members, most of whom are people living with multiple sclerosis. And now, iConquer MS has plans to expand its participant community to include MS caregivers themselves. Full disclosure, I'm serving as the co-lead in this project, and we want to make sure that we capture feedback from MS caregivers, researchers, and healthcare providers as we design and implement support for MS caregivers and for MS caregiver research within iConquer MS. That's why your opinion is so important. Once your feedback can be incorporated into the process, iConquer MS membership will engage MS caregivers. iConquer MS will also partner with researchers to support their work in MS caregiver research and will support healthcare providers and their needs for information and resources related to caregiver well-being. If you're an MS caregiver, researcher, or a healthcare provider who interacts with MS caregivers, I hope you'll give just 10 minutes of your time to completing an important online survey. You'll find the appropriate links to that survey for caregivers, healthcare providers, and researchers in today's show notes. And whether you're a caregiver or you're someone living with MS, the journey to getting an MS diagnosis can be stressful. Like MS itself, different people have very different experiences when it comes to receiving a confirmed diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. My guest today is Dr. Michael Robers, and we're talking about some of the twists and turns that can pop up on the road to being diagnosed with MS. In a moment, we'll meet Dr. Michael Robers. As many of you listening already know, getting an MS diagnosis can be tricky. For some, it's a straightforward and quick path to diagnosis. And for others, it can mean going through years of frustration before finally arriving at that diagnosis. Well, joining me to illuminate that path to diagnosis is Dr. Michael Robers. Dr. Robers is a neurologist in the Multiple Sclerosis Program and an assistant professor in the Department of Neurology at Barrow Neurological Institute. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Robers.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what makes MS so tricky to diagnose, and why are so many people misdiagnosed?
Well, multiple sclerosis or MS is a disease that affects everyone differently. The presenting symptoms can be different. Symptoms can come and then go, or symptoms can gradually get worse over time. And that wide variety in symptoms and how people present can make it difficult to diagnose. In addition, there's no one test that we can do that 100% says yes or no, this is MS. And so it really does need an expert to take the story, the history, and all of those tests to really determine whether the diagnosis fits.
And can you tell us which tests are used to arrive at that MS diagnosis?
The mainstays of diagnosis for multiple sclerosis is a history and neurologic exam from a neurologist, preferably an MS specialist, and then an MRI to really look for visual lesions typical of multiple sclerosis in the brain and spinal cord. Sometimes that's enough to give a diagnosis. Other times we still have questions, are still a little confused, and then we might order additional tests. Those might commonly include a lumbar puncture where we collect the cerebral spinal fluid from around the brain and spinal cord from the lower back and run tests looking for autoimmunity. It might include things that we call evoked potentials, looking for the speed of electricity in the nerves, either through the spinal cord or through the optic nerve in the back of the eye. Or newer version of that eye test is something called OCT, or optical coherence tomography, which actually measures the thickness of the different retinal layers and can be indicative of past damage to the optic nerve.
For a lot of people, the journey to diagnosis really begins with unexplained symptoms. What are some of the common initial MS symptoms that people may experience? And are those symptoms the same for everybody?
I'll answer the second question first. The symptoms are clearly not the same for everybody. They can be different for almost everybody. Many symptoms with the MS diagnosis are something that can be from so many different diagnoses that it's hard to track. So what we look for, while the symptoms may be different in different people, are things that follow a typical pattern, what we call a demyelinating event. And common diagnoses of that might be optic neuritis, which is typically pain and vision loss in one eye that lasts for days or longer, or transverse myelitis, which is oftentimes like weakness or numbness or bowel bladder changes in both legs. Someone might experience a line across their body where everything above it feels normal and everything below it feels abnormal and isn't working properly, or might have almost like stroke-like symptoms, might have numbness and weakness in one side of their body, like face and arm or arm and leg. And while all of those symptoms are different and might last for different amounts of time in different people, what we look for is this pattern of not being instantaneous, coming on over the course of maybe hours or a day or a little bit longer, and then not being instantaneous in resolving either. These aren't symptoms that come and go within minutes or even hours. They're symptoms that usually last longer than 24 hours and sometimes significantly more than that.
MS symptoms can come and go, and that can make it hard to know what you should be paying special attention to. So how does someone know when they should seek medical care? And when they arrive at that moment, who should they call?
The number one rule that I tell people is you know your body better than I do. And so if you're concerned, then it's appropriate to reach out and to contact someone and to seek medical care for that concern. Within that, times that we are specifically concerned about either a multiple sclerosis relapse in someone who already has a diagnosis or concerned about the diagnosis of MS really is these, well, neurologic symptoms, numbness, weakness, vision loss, double vision, severe dizziness, and poor balance that come on over the course of hours or a day or two and last days and sometimes longer is really what cues us in to be worried that this might be MS relapse or multiple sclerosis if it's a first-time diagnosis. Who to contact depends on where you are in that living with MS journey. If you've never been diagnosed, you might need to go through your primary care doctor to present symptoms and say, hey, something's wrong, and should I be seeing a specialist? If you already have a neurologist or an MS expert and you already have a diagnosis, you should be contacting the person who helps care for your MS typically. They're going to be the best experts in what to do, what to test, rule out. That being said, if there's ever a true emergency that you don't feel can wait until your outpatient doctor can see you or talk to you, it's also okay to go to an emergency room, although those will not be typically MS experts that you see there. So that's for truly, this can't wait, I need to go now.
Members of underserved minority communities can face additional challenges in being diagnosed with MS. Do initial MS symptoms vary among different races and ethnicities?
It is possible that the symptoms may actually differ between different race and ethnic groups. There is some research, especially in the United States, that shows that Black and Hispanic or Latinx populations and people have more motor symptoms or possibly optic neuritis, that vision loss and pain in that eye, than white populations, which tend to have more sensory symptoms, numbness, tingling at the beginning of a disease process. And that may in of itself be related to something going on in MS. It may be related to other medical conditions that are different between racial and ethnic groups. We know that health disparities exist in multiple sclerosis, but also in comorbidities like hypertension and diabetes that may actually change the course of MS. But also, we should acknowledge that race in of itself is a social construct and probably does not predict a clear biologic difference in the disease. And so what may be driving this realization that people present in different ways is that because we don't recognize MS enough in Black or Hispanic Latinx populations, that those individuals who have lesser symptoms, milder symptoms, may not get diagnosed with MS as quickly as a white female who meets all the textbook pictures for MS. And that might be skewing these results of how people actually present.
One of the challenges for members of the Black community is that there are doctors who believe that Black people can't get MS. They define it as a disease that affects white women. It's 2022. Why is this still happening?
It's really unfortunate and sad that's happening. And the simple answer is that it is medical racism in medical education, that the textbooks continue to show young white women as the picture of multiple sclerosis. When we go through medical training, we are trained for pattern recognition to get as quickly as possible through all the different information and get a picture that we can draw and say, this fits this diagnosis that I already know. And the picture that is drawn for us in most medical schools across the country for multiple sclerosis is a young white female. And that disadvantages people who don't look like that. That disadvantages older people who may present with a progressive form of MS and don't fit that classic picture. It disadvantages Black, Hispanic, Latinx, also possibly indigenous populations. And it disadvantages anyone who doesn't look like that picture. And so it really needs to be a change in the medical education system of medical students and neurologists to better appreciate and diagnose multiple sclerosis earlier in minority communities.
Many people express a sense of relief when they finally receive their MS diagnosis, because at last they have an answer to those unexplained symptoms that they've been experiencing. But that relief really doesn't last very long as they start wondering what their diagnosis means. It's that fear of the unknown and the unpredictability of MS. And that's a tough combination to work through. What's the best way to address those feelings of uncertainty?
I think it's really important to say that those feelings of uncertainty or concern or dread and unknown is really common. And it is okay and appropriate for someone who's having a life-changing diagnosis to have questions and to have concerns. There's a lot of good resources to help with that. The first one I would say is your doctor. If you're someone who has recently been diagnosed with MS or has been living with MS for a long period of time and just has questions and about what the future holds, talk to your doctor, who may have the best insight into your particular case and what can be done or what to expect in the future. In addition, many MS specialty clinics might have social workers or other expertise that can help with some of the stress and unknown and transitions. And then there's external sources of information. So educating yourself, there's great resources through programs like the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, the Multiple Sclerosis Association of America, local chapters of different organizations like that may have support groups that you can reach out to, may have ways to connect to people who are taking similar medications that you have questions on. And then really finding that support group, whether it's your friends, your family, other people with MS through these agencies, making sure you have a community around you to help support you through this.
And you know, it's not only newly diagnosed people who face feelings of uncertainty. We're living through some of the most stressful times in modern history. For the past 2 years, I think the entire world has experienced feelings of uncertainty. And we know that emotional well-being is an important component of overall wellness. And we know that stress can make some other MS symptoms even worse. So what are some things that people can do to best manage their stress?
I think it's okay to recognize that what works for one person may not work for other people. And so give some different things a try, and it's okay to stop something if it doesn't work. But several kind of the suggestions that I have is exercise is one of those things that's good for stress. Very good medical research saying that it reduces stress, but also has some evidence that it may actually help with MS itself in terms of maintaining mobility and strength for as long as possible. And if you're someone who's able to exercise and is able to get improvements in stress levels from exercise, that would be a great thing. I think it's okay to unplug a little bit from some of the stressful news. We don't have to be on 24-hour news networks and doom scrolling through Twitter or other social media networks. If you know that you have a trigger that really increases your stress, it's okay to step away from that, whether it is a kind of external source or even certain individuals or negativity. If you're able to step away from that, that's a good thing. And then really turning and finding that support group again. And we mentioned last time might be different for everyone, whether it's a formal support group through something like the National MS Society, or whether it's your family or close friends, having a group of people who can acknowledge what you're going through and support you through that is really important. And like you said, this is something the whole world is going through. It is normal to have questions and uncertainty and anxiety related to that. And it's important to say, if you're having significant anxiety or depression that is affecting your life, it is okay to seek help, whether that be through a psychologist, through counseling, or through a psychiatrist or medication. Talk to your doctor if you're having significant depression, anxiety symptoms that need to be addressed.
Dr. Michael Robers, thank you for all you do to improve the lives of people living with MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me. I love listening to your podcast, and it's an honor to be here.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/245. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.